Welcome back to the Dirt Show. Ever since Alex Murdaugh was convicted of murdering his wife and son, I would say dozens of people ask me the same question. People come up to me on the street and restaurants. How would you have defended him? Could you have gotten him off? The answer to the second is probably not. I did participate in the trial and the acquittal of O.J. Simpson, against whom the evidence was overwhelming. But as you'll hear later in this discussion, we didn't win the O.J. Simpson case. The prosecutors lost it. They blew it in every possible way. But as to the first question, how would I have defended Murtaugh exactly the same way we defended O.J. Simpson? Never would have put him on the witness stand. Would have introduced no witnesses whatsoever, except for distinguished scientists, forensic scientists, presented the narrowest technical scientific case, simply challenging all the state's forensic evidence, the Snapchat, the cell phone evidence, the whereabouts, the bullets. That would have left a lot of unanswered questions. But that's the role of the defense attorney, to create unanswered questions. Once he took the witness stand, he had an obligation to answer all the questions. He had to admit that he was at the kennels, having previously denied it. He had to admit all the lies he had previously told. He had to admit all the cheating he did of his partners and of clients. If you don't take the stand, if you don't put on an affirmative case, which of course you're not obliged to do, the questions stay out there. And jurors wonder sometimes. They also wonder why you didn't take the stand. If you're innocent, why you didn't take the stand. But your lawyer's job is to explain to the jury that there's no constitutional obligation or moral or any kind of obligation to take the stand. The government has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And there were a lot of people out there who thought there was a reasonable doubt. I wasn't there. I didn't follow the evidence on a day-to-day basis, but there seemed to be a lot of circumstantial evidence against him. But circumstantial evidence, there's often alternative explanations, and it's the job of the lawyer to give the alternative explanations, not the job of the defendant. And moreover, under our system of law, the lawyer can do that without putting on evidence. The lawyer can simply point to holes in the prosecution's case and emphasize over and over and over again that the government didn't prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, didn't prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. There's an alternative explanation, and leave the jury with some element of doubt. Once the defendant takes the witness stand, the jurors forget everything. That's why it was a three-hour deliberation. The only issue that the jurors faced was, we looked Murtaugh in the eye, and we don't believe him. We don't believe him. He admitted he was a liar. He not only lied about, to his clients and to his partners, he lied to us. He lied to investigators. He lied about relevant material. We're not thinking now about lying about his clients, but he lied about his whereabouts on the day of the murder. He lied about relevant information. And that's not only why the jury convicted, they just looked him in the eye and didn't believe him, it's why it's going to be very hard to win an appellate reversal. Now, people are shocked when they hear that 95% in some jurisdictions, it's 97%, in some it's 94%, it's none under 90%. 90-something percent of all criminal appeals are affirmed. That is, you lose 90-something percent of the cases. You win only 5 or 6%. I've been very lucky. I've won the vast majority of my murder. I've done around 30 homicide-related cases, attempted murder, assault with intent to kill, many murder cases, and I've won almost all of them on appeal. I've done a few of them at trial, but mostly they've been appeals, and I've won them all virtually on science, on technology, on forensics. I've managed to show the appellate courts that there were alternative routes. I guess my most interesting case was when my client was convicted of murdering his friend in the basement of his home after a drug deal. And the evidence showed that when my client shot him, he had already been shot by the third co-defendant, the third drug dealer in the case. And the evidence didn't prove beyond reasonable doubt that he was alive when my client shot him in the head, the other criminal having already shot him in the heart. And so we got the murder conviction thrown out. And then they convicted him of attempted murder. And the question was, could you attempt to kill a corpse? And we won that case as well, ultimately. But most of the cases I've won, I've just won by challenging the science. I taught my students for 50 years, you want to be a lawyer? Don't have to know all the cases, but you have to know all the science. You have to be the most knowledgeable person in that courtroom when it comes to science. You have to be more knowledgeable than the judge, more knowledgeable than the prosecutor, and this is the secret. You have to be more knowledgeable than the experts. And that's how you win these cases. We were able to demonstrate in the Klaus von Bülow case that all the experts were wrong, that there was no insulin in the case, and that it would not be possible for Klaus von Bülow to have injected his wife with insulin. We were able to prove that. In the O.J. Simpson case, again, we didn't win it. They lost it. They introduced a sock. We all know about the glove. But they introduced the sock that they claimed had the blood of both O.J. Simpson and his victim. And it did. The problem is it couldn't have got there legitimately because we were able to demonstrate that if a sock is soaked with blood, when the defendant is wearing it running through the blood field, then you get different blood patterns on each four sides because the leg is in the middle. And we were able to show that the patterns on all four sides were identical, showing that blood was poured on the sock when it was lying flat. Also, the blood had EDTA, which is a decoagulant that's not found in the human body. It's rat poison, essentially. And but it's found in the test tube that Officer Van Adder had in Tacoma them and poured on the sock. And the jurors said to themselves, look, we're convinced the police tampered with one piece of evidence. Who knows whether they tampered with others? Reasonable doubt. And so most of the jurors focused on that sock. And O.J. Simpson didn't take the stand. Here, big secret. It's been revealed before, so I can tell you. O.J. Simpson wanted to take the witness stand. So did F. Lee Bailey, who was one of his main lawyers. Bailey said, look, you're innocent. You should take the stand. The rest of us, essentially led by me, said, no, you can't take the witness stand. We've put on a very strong forensic case. The minute you testify, the jury forgets about the forensic case and says, well, this guy beat his wife once. I don't know. How did he get that cut on his hand? The explanation isn't very good. They would have convicted him. But he didn't take the stand. And Barry Scheck was able, and with Johnny Cochran, to emphasize the failings of the prosecution's case. Also, the two lawyers for the prosecution were less than excellent. You may remember them, Marsha Clark and Darden. Darden pulled off the bonehead play of the century by having O.J. try on the glove. I was there. I was literally, I don't know, 2 feet away from O.J. Simpson when he tried on the glove, and he walked right up to the jury. And he testified. That's why we didn't have to have him testify. He said to the jury, it's too small. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. I remember walking into the courthouse one day, and there were people from the Jewish Defense League who wanted O.J. convicted, and they were holding signs up which said, if you acquit, you're full of shit. So, you know, you can make up poems on either side. But the key is you have to know the strengths and weaknesses of your case. I strongly suspect, I don't know the answer to this, I strongly suspect that Murtaugh's lawyers, who apparently were very good, they have good reputations, didn't want him to testify, but he's a lawyer. And the defendant has an absolute constitutional right to testify. It's not something that a lawyer can waive. the lawyer could quit the case. I actually threatened to do that in the OJ case. The lawyer can threaten to quit and can quit if he disagrees with the client's decision to take the witness stand, or if he believes that the client would lie on the witness stand. No lawyer is allowed to put on a client who's lying, even if the client wants to go on the witness stand. That's a real dilemma for many, many criminal defense lawyers. But I suspect Murtaugh insisted on taking the witness stand, thinking he had conned the world out of so many things over his long career as a criminal lawyer. He had conned his clients. He had conned his partners. Shouldn't have any problem conning the jury. Well, no, he didn't fool the jury, and the jury came back in 3 hours. But again, I'm not sure he would have been acquitted had he not taken the witness stand. But as soon as I saw him take the witness stand, I predicted he was going to be convicted. That was the moment. As soon as he had to admit that was his voice on the Snapchat, and you can watch it on Google or YouTube or whatever, you can see. And there he was at the kennel at a time close to the time of the alleged murders, although he didn't have to admit when the murders occurred. His defense didn't have to admit that. They challenged it, and they could have challenged it. And they did challenge the cell phone testimony, but the jury didn't think about that. That's technical stuff. The jury isn't an expert in that. What a jury is an expert at is looking the defendant in the eye and saying, I don't trust him. I don't believe him. He killed them. You know, he had a pretty good defense, although he didn't do a good job making the defense. I mean, the basic defense is there's an enormous difference between cheating your clients, cheating your partners, and murdering your son, blowing your son's head off. There's a real difference. And that doesn't mean he didn't do it. It doesn't mean he's not a psychopath. It doesn't mean that he didn't kill his wife or maybe the housekeeper. We don't know. There's still more to be investigated. He certainly didn't present himself as somebody the jury would like. But if he hadn't testified, and it was only the defense attorney who was arguing to the jury, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, don't assume that a man who could cheat strangers could kill his son. I mean, that could be an argument that it could be made. But once he took the witness stand, the jury was focused on him. The jury looked him in the eye, and the jurors said, he lied to us. He lied to the police. He lied to investigators. We know he lied to so many, so many other people. And the excuse that he was a drug addict, that doesn't wash. He was a successful lawyer. He made a lot of hard decisions and relatively rational decisions in his life. But, you know, maybe he'll argue an appeal that the decision to take the witness stand was affected by his drug use and that he shouldn't have taken the witness stand. I don't think that will work. Look, every criminal lawyer I know tells the same story. The jails are filled with two kinds of people who have been convicted of serious crimes. Half of them are there, they say, because their lawyer allowed them to testify. And half of them are there because their lawyer didn't allow them to testify. The one thing you know about people who have been convicted of crime, they always blame their lawyers. Most of them don't have the introspection to understand that they're there because of what they did, not because of what the lawyer did or didn't do. But I used to teach my students, whatever decision you make about putting a client on the stand, if they're convicted, you're going to be blamed for it. I had a friend who was a great criminal lawyer. And he said he used to charge, that was in the old days, today it's more expensive. He would charge $100,000 to defend somebody in a murder case. He said $5,000 was for his time and $95,000 was for the decision whether to recommend taking the witness stand or not. It's the hardest decision of all. The two kind of lawyers, criminal lawyers, I don't like are the half that say I never put my client on the witness stand and the half that say I always put my client on the witness stand, both are just dead wrong. You can't always, you can't, if you're a criminal defense lawyer, buy your suit off the rack. It has to be tailor-made. And you have to make that decision based on the dynamics, based on everything that's gone on in the trial, based on the relationship you have and your client has with the jury. I remember after the glove situation in the Los Angeles court, we had a team meeting with O.J. Simpson in his prison cell. And at that point, it was just clear to everybody, not necessarily to O.J. and to F. Lee Bailey, but it was just clear to everybody else that he had won the jury over, not by taking the stand, but by just not fitting into that glove. And then that fit nicely into the forensic arguments that Barry Scheck and some of the other lawyers were making. And so in the end, the O.J. Simpson case was a forensic case. In the end, the Klaus von Bülow case was a forensic case. At another case where a doctor was convicted of murdering his wife by injecting her again. And we were able to demonstrate that she had, in fact, died of an arrhythmia in her sleep. And it had nothing to do with an injection that she had received days before for unrelated matters. We were able to prove it scientifically. We didn't have any burden to prove it scientifically. It would be enough if the jury came away saying, you know, maybe he injected her, maybe he didn't. The first question you ask if you're a criminal defense lawyer to the jury is when you're voir diring the jurors and to see whether or not they can serve on the jury. The first question you ask them is, sir or ma'am, if after hearing all the evidence, you come away thinking that he probably did it, how would you vote? And if they say we'd vote guilty, you throw them off. Probably isn't enough. He probably did it isn't enough. If he probably did it, you have to acquit. And that's very counterintuitive. Letting somebody out on the street who you believe probably killed somebody? How many of us could do that? But that's what a jury is sworn to do. If he probably did it, there's a reasonable doubt. You have to be relatively certain. You can't be absolutely certain. Only the good Lord knows who did it and who didn't do it. Good Lord may not always know. When Cain killed Abel, God wasn't sure and asked Cain, where's your brother Abel? So maybe even the good Lord doesn't know. Maybe he was just testing him. He was cross-examining him. And, you know, that's the first recorded murder in the Bible. And because there was no law against murder at the time, essentially, Cain gets acquitted and walks and becomes a builder of great cities. But of course, he walked around with the mark of Cain. That's probably punishment enough of the Bible. So he's been convicted. He's been sentenced to life imprisonment plus. He'll never see freedom again. And he'll appeal. And what will he appeal on? What would I appeal on after all, I've done probably more criminal murder appeals than any other lawyer in the country, I think. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I've done many, 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 many of them. And I've never been in a case where there are no appellate issues. There are always appellate issues. The first thing you do when you're an appellate lawyer is you go through all the objections that were made to make sure that whatever issues there are preserved on appeal. And I suspect some of the issues in this case will be the introduction of other crimes evidence, the introduction of the state's theory that he was motivated to kill because he wanted to deflect attention away from his stealing money from his clients. That's one of the dumbest arguments I've ever heard. You kill your wife and your son because you don't want to be convicted of stealing money from your client. That will deflect attention from it, right? It will direct all the attention of the world to it if you're charged with killing your wife and your son. So the prosecution's theory of motive was nonsense. But you don't need motives. People kill for all kinds of strange reasons. We don't know the dynamics the family dynamics between him and his wife, and even between him and his son. We assume that if you have a son and you call him by his nickname and you seem to have a good relationship with him in photographs, that probably you love him. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. We just don't know enough about that. The prosecution's theory of motive makes no sense whatsoever. And I'm sure the jurors didn't buy into that. They didn't have to, because you don't have to prove motive. In a murder case, all you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that the circumstances were such that it is nearly certain that he did it. And there's no other really alternative explanation for the bullet casings, for his voice on the Snapchat, for other evidence. But, you know, also the prosecution has to explain why there was no blood splatter on his clothing or around him. Did he have enough time to actually go and change his clothing and clean himself and then destroy all the clothing and make it disappear? There's no murder weapon. There is some suggestion that the forensics may suggest that there were two shooters rather than one shooter. All of these things could have been argued had he not taken the witness stand. Once having taken the witness stand, the case was over. Again, I don't know all the facts. I don't want to second guess. Maybe he thought that once the Snapchat came out and proved he had lied and proved that he was actually at the kennels at around the time of the murder, maybe he felt he had to explain that and rebut it. He was wrong if he believed that. But I can't criticize the lawyers because I don't know what their advice was, and probably will never know what their advice was. So that's my literally Monday afternoon quarterbacking. It's Monday afternoon and I am quarterbacking, and there's dangers in doing that. But as I've said, with all due modesty, I probably have as much of experience in consulting with trying appealing murder cases as anybody. And so my views are not just amateurish. They're based on lots and lots of experience and lots of success in defending murder, attempted murder, those kinds of cases. Not only the ones you've heard about, not only the famous ones. I've represented a lot of obscure poor people, people on death row, two young kids who were about to die, who broke their father out of prison. And then the father killed five people, and the father was killed. And then the two boys were sentenced to death. And I litigated that case for years and years and years and finally saved their lives. So lots and lots of experience in the 84 years of my life and the 60 years of practicing law and working on capital cases. The first case I ever worked on, as a law clerk, was a capital murder case. The first case I worked on as a lawyer, law professor, was a capital murder case. Started out as a capital murder case. And so I've done a lot of them. And I'm not optimistic for him and his ability to get a reversal on appeal, but stranger things have happened, so stay tuned. Okay, I'm sure we'll get a lot of letters about Murtaugh and about why he was convicted, but let's turn now to letters on last week's show. Okay. Thank you for emphasizing meritocracy, humanity, and equality as the process to judge the contents of character instead of identity politics to get diversity. Yes. Yes, common sense prevails. You know what's going on now? It's really interesting. I'll do a show on it. Every major university, every major medical school, every major law school is anticipating a Supreme Court decision in the next few weeks in which the Supreme Court holds that race as such cannot be considered as part of an admission process to any public university or any private university that receives federal funding, which means all private universities. And so they're already planning how to circumvent it. They're already planning how to get around it. They're already planning how to make sure that the result is not to reduce the number of minority students, but to keep it at about the same level it is today, ranging somewhere between 15 and 20%, depending on the school, et cetera. How are they doing it? Very simple. They're abolishing grades. They're abolishing standardized tests. They're abolishing every possible objective criteria for admission, allowing them, therefore, to make decisions that can't be demonstrated to be based on race. How do you demonstrate it? The case involving Harvard, it was easy to demonstrate. You saw that Asian students, many of them had very, very, very high test scores and very, very, very good grades, and they were denied admission. And therefore, it became fairly obvious that there was discrimination against Asian students, just as there had been discrimination against Jewish students for so many years with quotas. But once you abolish grades and SATs, how do you go about proving it? The school just says, well, we looked at the totality of the circumstances, and miraculously, the totality of the circumstances has produced the exact same number of minorities as it used to be when we considered race. Wow. So it was never important to consider race. We made the argument that it was essential, but we were wrong. We were wrong. That's what's going on. We're seeing it in front of our eyes. And we're seeing the number of Asian students and Jewish students and other students being reduced very, very substantially. An article in Tablet magazine this month that shows those percentages has dramatically dropped. As soon as you eliminate objective tests, as soon as you eliminate the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the ACT test, the Law School Aptitude Test, the Medical Board Test, the Business School Board Test, there are no objective criteria, and the school can admit whoever they want without being accused of using race as a criteria. So it's a direct attempt to circumvent. My former colleague Larry Tribe, months ago, recommended and said schools ought to be working on ways of getting around the Supreme Court's decision when the Supreme Court decides that race as such cannot be considered. So stay tuned, because I think we're going to see more litigation, but it's going to be harder litigation to bring because they won't be able to look at objective test scores. But the real question is, what impact is that going to have on you and your family when doctors are admitted to medical school, not necessarily on a meritocratic basis? What impact is it going to have when engineers, when pilots, lawyers, probably we can do without, but there are some areas where life is at stake, and the death of meritocracy can mean deaths of human beings. So I hope that we stick to the American dream of Martin Luther King, that people will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, by their performance. You can go beyond test scores, you can go beyond grades, you can go beyond all of that, as long as you base it on meritocracy, not on identity politics. Nobody should be rewarded or punished for the accident of race or ethnicity or gender or anything else that is beyond their control. I see you've added articles to your local site. Oh yeah, let's everybody get on Locals. Let's remember. That's great. I've watched Locals since you've been on it. I like the clip you make, but the articles are a real bonus. Question: how is it possible for you to write three books in a year? Do you sleep? If your brain could join a union, it would demand shorter work days and a 5-day work week. Look, I love to write. I write every day. I'm writing a new book called The Preventive State, and I wrote, a chapter today on free speech and prevention. And so, yeah, don't deprive me of my love. Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am. I say, I write, therefore I am." So, I love writing. I'm on my 53rd book. And I hope the good Lord gives me the power and strength to get to at least 60. I agree there should not be any prayer in school, but what do you think about having a moment of silence? It can be used for prayer or self-reflection. I'm in favor of that, as long as teachers aren't allowed to in any way dictate what that moment of silence is. A teacher should not be able to say, "Children, you now have a moment of silence. You can pray. You can reflect." No, I don't want teachers to be able to do that. I want teachers to be able to say, "You have a moment of silence to do whatever it is you prefer to do." And that's it. Then if students want to pray, they can pray. if they want to think about, you know, the girl next seat, if they want to think about the next sports event, they can do that. If they want to think about big issues in life, they can do that. I would encourage that. Okay. Belief in God and prayer do not need to be religious. I know plenty of people who are not religious, but they believe in God. Well, you mean not observant. If you believe in God, you're religious. Atheism is a religion. Having a moment of silence for each child to think about a higher force is a good thing. Again, I have no problem with the moment of silence. There's no such thing, however, as non-denominational prayer. The Lord's Prayer is not non-denominational. The Ten Commandments are not non-denominational. In fact, the Catholics, Protestants, and Jews order the commandments in different ways. For example, the Jews don't call it the Ten Commandments. They call it Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Statements, because the first one is, I am the Lord your God who has brought you out of Egypt. That's not a commandment. That's a description of a biblical fact. So, lots of things to think about, lots of things to talk about. By tomorrow, there'll be new news, and I'm sure some really good letters. So, I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow, and join our locals community. Oh, and get on TikTok. TikTok? Yeah, is that what it's, you call it? TikTok, and listen to the little blurbs. And so, if you haven't gotten enough of me, TikTok, locals, you can get me 24 hours a day. See you tomorrow.